Welcome to an international edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we hear from an analyst about providing U.S. forces better access in the fight against ISIS. Consider a discussion of the Iran nuclear deal on Capitol Hill. Scientists finally figure out why the gals are so cold at the office.
It's beyond the comfort question. It's just a waste of energy.
And there's another big name breakup in the world of country music. It's here on The Voice of America. A UN Security Council vote is expected as early as Friday on a U.S. draft resolution aimed at determining who is responsible for chemical weapons attacks in Syria so that they can be brought to justice. My colleague Victor Beatty is following that story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, the draft, it follows months of discussions between the United States and Russia, an ally of Syria, and also holds veto powers. Syria has agreed to destroy its chemical weapons stockpile, but allegations of chlorine gas attacks continue. Meanwhile, Iran, another ally of Syria, says it will soon submit a proposed peace plan to end Syria's civil war to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Iran's deputy foreign minister says many of the players believe a political solution is the most appropriate way to solve the four-year conflict that has killed an estimated 230,000 people and displaced millions more. Meanwhile, Wednesday, the United States confirmed its first airborne attack on Islamic State fighters in northern Syria using an unmanned drone that took off from a Turkish airbase. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas told me it gives U.S. forces the capability to more quickly react to events on the ground.
Before this time, we were taking off from sites in the sea, in the Mediterranean, the Persian Gulf, and elsewhere. And now we're much closer. So our reaction time is much more immediate, so it's significant. And the fact that the Turks are on board with this is also significant, and I think could be the beginning of a significant degrading of the Islamic State's capability.
Will there be a further U.S. involvement in the Syrian conflict as a result of this?
There could be. I think the U.S. is hoping for a solution akin to what happened in Afghanistan post-9/11, in the sense that we allied ourselves with local groups and Afghanistan with the Northern Alliance to overthrow the Taliban, supported by U.S. airstrikes, in Syria and Iraq with Kurdish and other elements supported by U.S. and other coalition airstrikes against ISIS. The complicating factor right now is Turkey, in that, of course, our alliance with the Kurds in Syria and Iraq is something they don't like very much because of what they perceive as the separatist movements of Kurds in eastern and southern Turkey, combined with Kurdish elements in Iran and Iraq and Syria. So I think that has to be something that has to be worked out. The Turks, I think, inevitably will have to swallow the fact that the U.S. is aligned with Kurdish elements in Syria and Iraq to degrade ISIS. And I think that's ultimately why the Turks came aboard the anti-ISIS coalition, in order to help control the diplomatic elements of this coalition, rather than to be isolated on the outside looking in. This way they are at the table and therefore can hopefully add to their feelings and their thoughts and their diplomatic positions to the U.S. Alliance with Kurdish elements in these areas.
David, is this part of the Turkey effort to create a safe zone in northern Syria?
That still has to be worked out. The U.S. and Turkey have an ambiguous agreement regarding a safe zone in Turkey. I think there's still a lot of negotiating left to be made regarding the nature of this safe zone. The U.S. certainly wants only certain elements in that safe zone that only fight Syrian opposition elements, that only fight ISIS. The Turks have long, of course, wanted a safe zone that provides safe haven for Syrian opposition elements that primarily go against the Assad regime. So that still has to be worked out, and that has yet to be decided. However, I think that with the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal, with U.S.-Russian-Iranian negotiations that have occurred and other diplomatic endeavors that have looked to resolve the Syrian situation, the Turks have got to get on board. And I think they'll ultimately relent in making ISIS the ultimate enemy rather than the Assad regime.
And Lesh says Syrian forces have been on the defensive for some months now, and that pressure, coupled with the Iranian peace proposal, may finally force the Assad government into serious political negotiations to end the conflict.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, welcome as always.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you.
We have two things that are trending right now on social media, two big events that are happening tonight. The first is the GOP debate. This is the Republican Party here in the U.S. It's the first presidential debate of the 2016 presidential election. So,
and they got so many candidates, they can't fit them all on one stage.
Well, that's the funny thing. That's what a lot of people are talking about on social media. They have what they're calling the happy hour debate.
Yeah.
It's the kind of the also-rans or the people who aren't polling as well. And then the main debate is the 10 candidates who are polling the highest out of, I believe it's 16 or 17
yeah.
Republicans that have already declared they're running. So this is, of course, a big topic here in the U.S., people saying, looking forward to the debate, wondering what questions they're going to ask. A lot of people focusing on Donald Trump. He's the front runner right now, and he has a way of sometimes making these brash comments.
Standing out in a crowd.
Exactly, and especially now that he's going to be on stage with nine other candidates, it's going to be interesting how he, what he has to say about them, how they attack him, how he attacks them. And Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, is also a very big brash personality, so people wondering how they're going to interact on the stage together. So a lot on social media about that. More, I'm sure, as we go into tonight with the debate and more into tomorrow.
Well, an interesting thing is going to be what you're going to say next is going on tonight, and that is who's going to watch the debates and who is going to watch the comedian.
Right, exactly. It's right after the debates, and a lot of actually bars here in Washington, or because it's a very political town, are doing dual parties. First, you watch the debate, and then you watch Jon Stewart. It's the comedian's last episode as host of The Daily Show. 16 years he's been doing it on the air. A lot of speculation about how his last show is going to end, who he's going to bring back on for maybe his guests, how he's going to sign off, and people sharing a lot of their favorite moments. I saw a hashtag that one person used, hashtag John Voyage, take on Bon Voyage, so I thought that was kind of funny.
And but, I've heard people of your generation say that they learned about politics by watching John on TV.
There's a huge number of young people that say that's how they get their news, is through places like Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert when he was on the air, and now John Oliver, who does a show similar to The Daily Show. So certainly a voice that'll be missed in comedy and in the news.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew, for stopping by. Always enjoy it.
Absolutely.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Researchers in the United Kingdom have found that high levels of three specific proteins in urine can indicate early-stage pancreatic cancer. They say that their discovery could lead to an inexpensive and non-invasive test to screen people who are at high risk of developing the often deadly disease. Today, pancreatic cancer is usually diagnosed at a late stage because it doesn't show any symptoms until it's too late. The research team at Barts Cancer Institute at Queen Mary University of London found that the particular three-protein signature can detect the most common form of pancreatic cancer when still in its early stages. The signature can also determine whether someone is suffering from a condition known as chronic pancreatitis and not cancer, conditions which can be difficult to tell apart from one another. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Iran nuclear deal is a major issue in Washington this week, with President Obama making statements about it and going before the U.S. Congress. My colleague Mohammed El-Shenawy followed the latest hearing at the Senate Armed Services Committee, which focused on that Iran nuclear deal, and he joins me now in the studio. Mohammed, what were the major concerns expressed?
So in his opening remarks, Senator John McCain, chair of the committee, specified certain outcomes of the nuclear agreement that was troubling to the region in his point of view.
This agreement will not only strengthen Iran's malign activities in the region, it will also further Iran's emergence as a dominant military power in the Middle East. Despite repeated assurances that negotiations were strictly limited to the nuclear program, the administration made major concessions related to conventional weapons and ballistic missiles.
Senator McCain said, with a windfall of sanctions relief estimated at about $60 billion, Iran could use the additional funds to finance its destabilizing activities in the Middle East.
Was there any expert at the hearing who had anything positive about the nuclear agreement with Iran?
Most of the experts who pointed out to the shortcomings of verification or eventual empowerment of Iranian influence in the Middle East. However, Ambassador Nicholas Burns, former senior diplomat and professor of international relations at Harvard University, described the deal as a combination of benefits and risks and said the U.S. can secure a successful outcome of the deal with Iran.
I think a lot's going to depend on the United States. Can we create strategic deterrence against the Iranians? Can we coerce and intimidate them from becoming a nuclear weapons power, not in the next 10 years because we'll freeze them, but in the follow-on 10 to 15 years?
However, Ambassador Burns warned against a congressional rejection of the deal and said such rejection would leave the United States in a weaker position because other partners would not follow through the same path that the United States would take. He told the committee that on the balance, he believes that the benefits outweigh the risks because rejecting the deal would free Iran from what he described as considerable amounts of restrictions contained in that deal.
Well, Mohammed, thank you very much for your insight.
Thank you for having me, Sue.
Coming up on International Edition, why does it feel so cold in here to the ladies? And romantic country music fans face a disappointment. Oil prices continue to slide, and the crash in gold prices is hitting China hard. Here to fill us in is business correspondent Alexis Christophorus. Alexis.
Thank you, Susan. More and more traders are getting the sense that oil prices may stay lower for longer. Oil futures for delivery in December of 2020 are currently trading $8 lower than they were at the beginning of this year. In other words, oil traders are now feeling much gloomier about oil prices several years out than they were at the beginning of this year. Crude seems to be languishing below $45 a barrel, and there are a number of factors at play here. The Iran nuclear deal, an ongoing production surplus, and economic concerns in Greece and China. Many oil companies are now in survival mode, and analysts expect a fresh round of cuts in spending and workforces for the oil industry. Meantime, gold's meltdown has cost Russia and China about $5.4 billion in just 3 weeks as prices slump to a five-year low. The bullion's tumble is especially painful for Russia and China, the biggest buyers of gold over the past 6 years. China has expanded its holdings by almost 60% since 2009, while Russia more than doubled its assets and added reserves. Gold seems to have lost its luster as a safe haven investment. And if U.S. interest rates go up this year, it will hurt gold even more because the precious metal doesn't pay interest like other investments like bonds. Susan?
Alexis, it seems that all eyes are on the U.S. jobs report we're expecting tomorrow. What do investors expect?
Investors will be mining that report for clues on whether the U.S. economy is strong enough to withstand an interest rate hike by the Federal Reserve. Economists are looking for 223,000 jobs to have been added in July and that the unemployment rate held steady at 5.3%. The key here is average hourly earnings. And if that comes with a 2% increase tomorrow, then it may be enough to convince the Fed to raise interest rates next month. And that, Susan, will mean the beginning of the end of cheap money for the U.S. and many foreign investors.
Well, thank you, Alexis.
You bet.
I'm Millar Sagan, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
In many offices, men are comfortably walking around in their short sleeves, while women are wrapped in sweaters or more. In other words, it's way too cold for us. Joining me is International Edition's Jeffrey Young, who found the scientist who researched this issue and found out what's going on. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. Yes, Boris Kingmout, a biophysicist at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, did a study on this phenomenon. And as he tells us, there is a scientific reason why many women say the office is a freezer.
Yes, we actually confirmed that women have a lower metabolic rate or a lower heat production than males. And this means that if you produce less heat, you also have to lose less heat to the environment. The consequence, if you have an environment that is slightly warmer, you will lose less heat.
When offices were set up for heating and air conditioning, do you think that women were even included in the research, in the survey? Do you think that there was gender bias involved here? Was it that blatant?
Now, in the original studies, definitely males and females were included. And the beautiful thing is of those studies is that they were dressed in the same clothing and they were performing the same activity. Now, what came out of this these studies is that they were able to find an optimal temperature that satisfied the majority of males and females. The second thing that they found out, actually, is that women were more sensitive to a deviation from that optimal temperature. Now, this brings a little subtlety to the story, of course, because back then it was concluded that metabolic rate didn't matter at all. But basically what we actually show with our biophysical model is that it's also a matter of a zone. So basically the women were closer to the edge of the comfort zone. And this is definitely explained also by metabolism.
Maybe the guys can just take their jackets off and the women will be warmer and won't have to hide under a blanket.
What's special for the American case is that offices are really too far in summer condition. And that's a waste of energy. So that's beyond the comfort question. It's just a waste of energy. So if you then just cool a little bit less, and you save a lot of energy, then women in general will, of course, feel a little bit more comfortable. Then, of course, there will be men that complain about being too warm because they're dressed, overdressed. One solution is indeed to reduce the clothing, take off a jacket. The idea that you would better have a colder environment because then at least you could dress more. Now, there are new alternatives being developed, is the local comfort systems. If you don't cool the entire building anymore that much and only provide on those office spaces or workspaces that require a little bit more cooling, and of course the other way around in winter.
That was biophysicist Boris Kingma at Maastricht University in the Netherlands.
The idea of individual temperature zones would be great, Jeffrey.
I agree. It's not fair to see women shivering.
Thanks, Jeff, for caring. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? How about old school technique meeting new age technology? Charging your smartphone with a candle. Set it up by placing the charger on top of a two-tier stand and pour water into the charger. A lit candle goes under the charger. Plug your mobile phone into a USB port coming off the charger, and that's it.
You have a hot side, like a hot plate, and you have a cold plate, and you smash these generators together. And it's that temperature difference. It creates a diffusion of energy from the hot side to the cold side.
Andrew Burns, co-founder of the startup company Stower, says the charger puts out between 2 and 3 watts, about the same amount of power available from a USB port.
The power of a mobile handset and a smartphone is infinitely greater than a vacuum cleaner, and they only need tiny little bits of energy.
Candle power, keeping smartphones lit. That's what's new from the Voice of America. I'm Todd Grosson.
There seems to be an outbreak of split-ups in the music world. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about the most recent high-profile breakup.
First, it was Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert. Now, Reba McEntire and her husband of 26 years. Nikki, this is there something in the water? It seems like these high-powered couples are just splitting up.
No, and it may be also a sign of the times that divorce is now an option. So I think they're taking advantage of it.
Oh,
that sounds
no.
Terrible.
You got money, I got money, bye.
Bye. So, yeah, so, that you know, Reba posted on her, I would say her Facebook page, but it's on her website, and that her and her husband, says Narvel Blackstock and Reba McEntire have announced that they have been separated.
Right.
For the past few months, despite this being the end of their marriage, they continue to support each other. They have worked together for 35 years and will continue to do so. They have asked that you respect their privacy during this time.
Lord, the sun is blinding me as it wakes me from the dark. I guess the world didn't stop
I mean, it's kind of sad. He's been her manager for 35 years.
Well, he was a steel guitar player in her band first.
He was before.
And they got married at like 1989 or something?
Yes, on a boat in Lake Tahoe. And what's kind of nice is that when they got home, they discovered that she was pregnant.
Oh, yeah. Now, her son, their son,
yes,
is a NASCAR driver.
Yes, he is. He is. And then I know that Blackstock has 3 children from a previous marriage. What's interesting is that Blackstock Management, his company, they're still going to represent Reba, of course, but they also represent Blake Shelton. And then on top of that, you also know that Gwen Stefani, who's a judge of The Voice, working with Blake Shelton.
Right. We're not doing a 6 degrees of separation.
Oh, my God.
Thing.
I'm just like, what is going on? What is in the waters? She just announced within hours of Reba's announcement that she's divorcing her husband.
Well, this is, we don't know the ins and outs of a relationship with these two people. I'm always saddened to see a marriage end just because it makes me sad.
Yeah.
But sometimes people do actually, you know, there are circumstances where it's like it's better for them to be apart.
I know.
Well, if you want to send us a tweet about this, you can send one to Nikki at @VOA_music. You can send one to us at @VOA_IE. You can also listen for Nikki's show, Country Hits USA. That's on www.voanews.com.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. As Dave just mentioned, you can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Afghan Minister of Finance Ekhlil Hakimi, the U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan P. Michael McKinley, and the USAID Mission Director William Hemmink signed a Memorandum of Understanding for the New Development Partnership on August 3, 2015, in Kabul. The New Development Partnership reflects the strategic importance of the U.S.-Afghanistan relationship and recognizes a new era of development cooperation between our governments. This initiative delivers on the commitment made during Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's March visit to Washington, during which President Barack Obama pledged to support the Afghan National Unity Government's efforts to achieve its own ambitious reform agenda. Afghanistan's Minister of Finance Hakimi thanked the U.S. for its generous support with the New Development Partnership, under which the U.S. will provide up to $800 million to Afghanistan to maintain and build on the development gains made over the last 13 years. U.S. Ambassador P. Michael McKinley remarked that the New Development Partnership represents a fundamental transformation in the nature of development cooperation between our two countries. It empowers Afghan solutions to Afghan challenges by incentivizing and rewarding Afghan successes. Afghanistan continues to face difficult challenges: recovery from decades of violent conflict, the continuing threat of violent extremism, the need to provide education, health care, and basic infrastructure for millions of men, women, and children. In meeting these challenges, Afghanistan will have the continued help of its friend and ally, the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.